This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
A very pleasant day to you. Welcome to Trumpet Hour. I'm Joel Hilliker. Today, U.S. Congress is scheduled to certify the Electoral College results of this past presidential election, but there has been so much evidence of voter fraud. Several lawmakers are saying they will object to that certification. We're watching closely to see how this plays out. In our first segment today, though, we're going to hear a report from a special correspondent, a computer programmer and IT worker, Dan Arnfield, about the susceptibility of voting machines to hacking. We also have an interview with the Prime Minister in exile of East Turkestan. This is the Xinjiang province of China, an area nearly half populated by Uyghurs. And the people in this area have established an exile government that they say is the sole legitimate authority to represent East Turkestan and its people until this territory has been liberated from Chinese rule. Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques spoke with the prime minister of this government, and they talked about the history of the area and what's happening to the Uyghurs there, many other subjects as well. Stay tuned for this fascinating interview. And we'll finish today's program with a Bible study. In these difficult times, it's more important than ever to be close to God, prioritizing our relationship with God and building intimacy in that relationship. So we'll talk about how to do that. Let's start, though, by looking at the vulnerabilities of America's electronic voting systems in this report from Dan Arnfield.
What is the most important quality to see in an election? There are many to choose from, such as speed, accuracy, and fairness, but arguably the most important is transparency. Transparency is how we know that elections are conducted fairly and legally. It helps people accept the results of the vote. When voting with paper ballots, transparency is pretty straightforward. Observers watch the voting process and the ballot counting, and you get a built-in paper trail that can be rechecked later. Rigging an election takes a lot of effort and is very difficult to keep hidden. It would certainly be impossible for a single person to rig such an election. But collecting and counting paper ballots is slow and prone to human error and human interpretation. We saw this in the 2000 U.S. presidential election, where lawyers debated in court whether so-called hanging chads should be counted as legal votes. It was after that election that many began pushing for electronic voting systems to replace old-fashioned paper ballots. Now, at first glance, this might seem like a good idea. A computer or a machine is certainly capable of being faster, more accurate, and more impartial than human poll workers. But switching to machines creates a massive, fundamental issue with the election process. It removes transparency and replaces it with trust. Specifically, trust in the people who build the hardware and write the software for the voting machines. But beyond that, you must also trust everyone who uses or interacts with the machines. Let's discuss that last group first. After the allegations that Russia hacked the 2016 presidential election, people started paying more attention to voting machine security. The next year, the hacker conference DEF CON introduced what they called the Voting Village, an opportunity for attendees to try to hack 25 types of voting machines and other equipment in use at that time for state and national elections. The following is a quote from the report on that first Voting Village. By the end of the conference, every piece of equipment in the Voting Village was effectively breached in some manner. Participants with little prior knowledge and only limited tools and resources were quite capable of undermining the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of these systems. Moreover, a closer physical examination of the machines found, as expected, multiple cases of foreign-manufactured internal parts, including hardware developed in China, highlighting the serious possibility of supply chain vulnerabilities, end quote. It's difficult to overstate how bleak their findings were. Voting computers accepted default administrator passwords that could be found on the internet or easily guessed. Most were running ancient software with well-documented, easily exploited flaws. Physical security was nearly non-existent. USB ports and flashcard readers could be accessed with a screwdriver or the simplest lockpicking techniques. Some machines didn't hide them at all and could be accessed by anyone walking by. Others could be hacked over Wi-Fi by anyone within a few hundred feet. Quoting again from the report, as one hacker remarked, with physical access to the back of the machine for 15 seconds, an attacker can do anything. Some of these problems could be forgiven by the fact that most of the machines featured were very old. But remember, nearly all of the machines tested were and still are in use today. And even if they were replaced with up-to-date devices, the 2019 Voting Village tested a number of current generation models, and they failed just as badly. Clearly, voting equipment suffers from abysmal security. The threat of hackers tampering with election results is very real and present. Even a single person attacking critical machines could influence or even flip an election. But there is another, perhaps even more pressing objection to electronic voting that has surfaced in the 2020 presidential election: interference from the manufacturers of the equipment. President Donald Trump and lawyer Sidney Powell, among others, have accused Dominion voting systems of influencing the presidential election by programming their voting machines to alter the results. Sidney Powell says she has strong statistical evidence that Dominion machines flipped a percentage of votes for Donald Trump to Joe Biden. Dominion, of course, denies these allegations. On the official company website, they state that Dominion systems do not have a secret vote-flipping algorithm. On that same page, they also address a claim that Dominion has servers in Germany to count votes. Quote, "No, all votes are counted in the U.S. by local election officials, not by Dominion. Voting systems are, by design, meant to be used as closed systems that are not networked, meaning not connected to the internet. It is technologically impossible to see votes being counted in real time and or to flip them," unquote. So who is right? That may be impossible to determine. A cleverly designed program could have flipped votes during the election, then deleted itself once the polls closed, leaving no trace, even under forensic analysis. Furthermore, Dominion's claim that their systems are never connected to the internet is incomplete at best. Their own training videos reveal that poll closing procedures can include connecting a cellular modem to the voting machines in order to upload election results to a central server. Besides that, the same video shows the machines are equipped with Ethernet ports, which makes it possible to connect them to the internet. Even if proper procedures are followed and the machines aren't networked, it is certainly not technologically impossible for the machines to be secretly equipped with a wireless internet connection. In fact, one of the machines tested in the DEFCON Voting Village featured the ability to transmit votes wirelessly in real time. There is no proof that any of this occurred, of course, but that isn't the point. Assuming Powell's evidence is accurate, an equally plausible explanation is that Dominion unwittingly built their machines with compromised microchips and China hacked our election. Or election officials could have themselves installed rigged software on their voting machines. Or, as already mentioned, a well-organized third party could have tampered with machines in several states at once. This is the fundamental flaw with electronic voting. Transparency has been replaced with trust. Trust in Dominion, in other voting system companies, in election officials, in the voters themselves. A betrayal of that trust at any level can compromise an entire election.
pretty fascinating stuff, Dan. Thank you very much for bringing that all together. Now, we were talking before about just some of the information that has been presented by Sidney Powell and the forensic analysis of these machines that she presented to a court. I can't keep up with all of the different lawsuits that she has filed, but you were saying that I guess there are some people who criticize this for having been flawed, but there's some of the concerns that she raised that have not been addressed.
That's right. I read through the original forensic analysis report that she presented, and I also read through a rebuttal that was presented by Dominion. It wasn't their analysis, but it was another expert in the field, a voting electronic voting expert. I can't remember what his name was. But he was addressing several points in the forensic analysis that were flawed. And I have to agree with his analysis. There were some serious problems with the forensic report. A lot of issues that they raised that were either overblown or misinterpreted. However, he didn't rebut the entire report. There were several sections of the analysis, including one where the people conducting it received these results of counts and then recounts of several local elections where the numbers changed between the two counts. The number of votes recorded for all of the different candidates were not at all consistent. Not in every case would those new counts have flipped that election or changed the results, but they were significant just by the fact that there were different numbers of votes counted between different runs of whatever summary software that county was using. The rebuttal
shouldn't happen.
Yeah, that shouldn't happen. The rebuttal didn't even try to address any of that, didn't even touch on it, didn't acknowledge that it was there. And yet the so-called expert concluded that he agreed with DHS in that this was the most secure election in U.S. history.
Yeah. Well, looking at these vulnerabilities that you're describing, it seems like the amount of concern over this is so overwhelming, especially when you consider who it is that we're dealing with. I think the way that you brought it up in your report, you're saying it's possible that you could have bad actors within the United States exploiting these vulnerabilities. It's also possible that you could have foreign actors exploiting these vulnerabilities. You mentioned China specifically. We're talking about two entities that have really proven their determination to undermine America by whatever means they have at their disposal repeatedly. And so you'd almost have to assume that that they have exploited those vulnerabilities. To just assume that they're behaving on their best behavior, that there's no problem here, is just the height of naivety, isn't it?
Absolutely. It would be like thinking that a burglar who's canvassing a neighborhood is just going to ignore the two houses that don't even have their front doors closed. It's just not reasonable to expect that no one has exploited these obvious deficiencies demonstrated several times. I mentioned DEFCON, the voting village. They ran that 3 years in a row. Every time, basically every piece of equipment there was compromised in multiple ways. This is not reasonable to believe that it has never been exploited and wasn't exploited in probably the most controversial election in U.S. history.
And I think especially when you're looking at this in light of what Gerald Fleury, our editor-in-chief, has written about the radical left and just how determined they are to get hold of power. We also have prophecies in the Bible that talk about just how vulnerable the United States is to cyber attack, and that this could very well be a tool or a weapon that the enemies of the United States use against us. It seems like this is the potential for this to have been turned the entire election around is just far too great to ignore.
I would absolutely agree with that.
Well, we certainly appreciate your time and looking into all of the details about that, sharing your findings with us. We've been talking with Dan Arnfield about these recent elections in the United States and some of the very concerning evidence that the voting machines are very susceptible to hacking. We really appreciate your time, Dan.
Thank you for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The plight of the people of the Xinjiang region of China has been gaining a fair amount of attention in recent months. But did you know that there is an area of this region aiming for liberation from Chinese rule and that has its own government in exile? The area is known as East Turkestan, and we'll hear now from the prime minister of this government, Salih Hudayr, in this interview with Jeremiah Jacques.
Salih Hudayr was born in the city of Artush, in a region that most of the world knows as Xinjiang, China. But he doesn't use that name. Xinjiang is a Mandarin name given to the region by the Chinese when they invaded and occupied it. Mr. Hudayr and millions of the people who lived there wish that Xinjiang had never been conquered by China, and they want the region to break free and regain its autonomy. So they call it by the name that it would have if it were free, which is East Turkestan. Mr. Hudayr spoke with Trumpet Hour on December 21st, and here is how he explained this region's history.
We've long maintained our independence until recently. It was firstly in 1876 that the Manchu Qing dynasty invaded East Turkestan, and in 1884 they were able to occupy it and renamed it to Xinjiang, meaning the new territory in the Chinese language. By the 1920s, the people of East Turkestan began to form national identity and began to resist. In 1933, we set up the first East Turkestan Republic, which was short-lived, roughly about 6 months before the Soviets intervened and overthrew it, fearing that we would encourage rebellion in what was then West Turkestan, the present-day countries of Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and so forth. Then in 1944, we declared independence once more as the East Turkestan Republic and maintained our independence until December 22nd, 1949. The Chinese communists, along with the Soviets, they assassinated the top 30 leaders of our republic, and then they invaded East Turkestan and overthrew our independent state.
Ever since then, this region's been an intermittent flashpoint for tensions between the Uyghur people, like Mr. Hudayr, they're mostly Turkic-speaking Muslims, and the Han Chinese people. The Han are mainly Mandarin-speaking atheists. They make up about 90% of China's total population. In the 1990s, the tensions between these two sides soared. This was partly because the Soviet Union had just collapsed, and nearby nations like Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan were declaring independence. East Turkestan wanted to do the same, but unlike the Soviet Union, China had not collapsed, and the Chinese wouldn't give the region its freedom. As the tensions increased, it prompted Hudayr and his family to flee to the United States.
My father had fled East Turkestan in 1995-96 because at that time the Chinese government was cracking down on all forms of Uyghur culture, political activities, and social activities under what they termed as the Strike Hard campaign. In 1997, the Chinese government, they brutally crushed a peaceful demonstration in the city of Gulja. And that same year, Amnesty International reported that about 100,000 people had been detained for various reasons, ranging from being labeled as ethnic nationalists, separatists, religious extremists, etc. My family was routinely harassed because of that, because of even our historical background in opposing the Chinese government. So my father, he was able to come to the United States in late 1997. And he applied for asylum, and then he tried to get us to the United States. And it was only about 2 years later that we were able to come to the United States.
Hudayar first studied ROTC, or Reserve Officers Training Corps, at the University of Central Oklahoma in Edmond. He later transferred to the University of Oklahoma and studied political science and international affairs. And meanwhile, back in Xinjiang, the Chinese Communist Party's crackdown on the Uyghurs and other minorities was reaching a terrifying intensity. In 2008, there were attacks that the Chinese said were carried out by Uyghur terrorists. These were bus bombings and attacks on police facilities. Chinese authorities said that the violence killed hundreds of mainly Han Chinese people. And China ended up using these attacks to justify deploying large numbers of People's Liberation Army soldiers to Xinjiang. The Chinese ended up turning the region into a police state. Ubiquitous cameras, police checkpoints everywhere, and the Chinese built numerous facilities that they euphemistically call re-education centers or vocational training schools. In reality, these are concentration camps.
The U.S. Department of Defense in May 2019, they stated that there was at least 1 million, but more likely 3 million people in what they said it is concentration camps. They specifically called it concentration camps because people are being sent without any charges, actual charges, into these facilities. They're forcibly indoctrinated to denounce their ethnic and religious identity and embrace, you know, the Chinese state. They are brainwashed to literally worship the Chinese state as the highest being. There is no God in communism, so this is what they are forced to do. And people in the camps, you know, they're forcibly, you know, medicated, forcibly starved. Women, you know, in these camps are raped by security forces, you know, whenever they feel like it. And people who resist or attempt to resist, they are killed for their organs. And these organs are shamelessly are sold to, you know, wealthy Muslims across the world, mostly in the Middle East, as halal organs, meaning that, you know, these people have not consumed what is described as haram products, like drinking alcohol or eating pork, stuff like that. And there is significant evidence of this. The satellite imagery analysis and Chinese government procurement data.
Mr. Hudayar says that China also uses a chilling program to forcibly breed Uyghur genes out of Xinjiang. With this, they're committing cultural genocide by father replacement.
In 2018, the Chinese state media announced that the Chinese government had sent 1.12 million Chinese officials to live in the homes of Uyghurs to help guide them to loyalty to the state. And many of these homes that they were sent to, you know, and it's called a relatives program officially, is to, you know, build bonds and promote ethnic unity is the official narrative. But the Chinese, many of the Chinese officials sent to the Uyghur homes are male officials, and they're usually sent to the homes where the head of the household is either in the camp or in prison. And in many instances, there's videos and photos of these male officials sleeping in the same bed under the same covers of the Uyghur women, stating that they are promoting ethnic unity between, you know, the Uyghurs and the Han Chinese population. We've heard of numerous instances where the Uyghur women were raped in their own homes. In some instances, the Chinese officials are like, you know, these are young men in most instances. And they're like, oh, well, we want to marry them. And if you refuse, then the Chinese government's like, oh, well, if you refuse, then we're going to send your other relatives to the concentration camp. And so there's this coerced forced marriages that's going on in East Turkestan. Tens of thousands of Uyghur women have been forcibly married to the Chinese men. There are some instances where women, young women, have committed suicide because they don't want to marry the Chinese men, while at the same time they also don't want their parents to be locked up and sent to the concentration camps because of them.
Mr. Hudayar also points out that the so-called terrorist attacks that China says the Uyghurs committed, and which the Chinese used to justify these concentration camps, he says that those were false flags that were actually committed by the Chinese Communist Party.
In East Turkestan, it's illegal to even, you know, have a knife. Every family household has one knife, and that's chained to the walls of their kitchen and etched with a barcode that has, you know, their entire family's information. So even if you were to, you know, carry out an attack, or if you dare to even carry out an attack, your whole family is going to be punished, not just you. So many people are discouraged from that. While at the same time, the Chinese government, you know, they've placed a massive security apparatus where there's hundreds, thousands of checkpoints, almost every 500 meters, millions of security cameras, and many of these attacks are targeting civilians. Previously, you know, in the East Turkestan people's, you know, struggle for the past 71 years, Uyghurs or others, they would always target, you know, Chinese security forces, but never civilians. And China needs to portray the Uyghurs as terrorists. So they carry out these, conveniently carry out these false flag operations. We think that it's a deliberate, you know, game played by Chinese intelligence to portray Uyghurs as terrorists and then to justify what it's doing, the genocide it's doing in East Turkestan under the guise of counterterrorism.
Mr. Hudayar has quite a lot of extended family and friends still back in East Turkestan, and he's been crushed to hear about many of them being put into these camps and subjected to this evil from the Chinese Communist Party. Four of his relatives have died in this system so far. And so his senior thesis at the University of Oklahoma was a proposal for the U.S. to recognize the national aspirations of the Uyghur people. Hudayar also proposed a Uyghur Policy Act in Congress. And all of this ended up bringing him into the limelight of the Uyghur community here in the U.S. He moved to Washington, D.C. in 2017 and became involved in the community there. And he realized that the Uyghur diaspora didn't really have as much of a voice as they should have.
I ended up getting involved with the community here, and I realized that we were largely silent and inactive. So I decided we need to effectively lobby Congress. We need to spread awareness. And so I established the East Turkestan National Awakening Movement to advocate for both the human rights and political rights of East Turkestan's people, more specifically advocating, you know, directly for independence.
The Uyghur community ended up asking Hudayar to represent the government in exile of East Turkestan. He served as an MP for a time, and then toward the end of 2019, the 8th General Assembly of the East Turkestan Government in Exile was convened in D.C., and he was nominated by the parliament, along with three other prominent members of the community, for the position of prime minister. And Hudayar was elected to the position. So he's the prime minister in exile of East Turkestan. Prime Minister Hudayar also says that Xinjiang, or East Turkestan, is only one part of the story.
First, they invaded South Mongolia, Southern Mongolia, or what China calls Inner Mongolia. Then they invaded East Turkestan. And then a couple months later, they invaded Tibet. Essentially, they've been doing the same policies of colonization, genocide, and occupation in all three of these countries.
Prime Minister Hudayar says that all of this is really only just the start for China, and that the country's ambitions go much further.
In 2013, Xi Jinping, he gave a grandiose speech in which he stated, you know, we are going to achieve the Chinese dream, Chinese national rejuvenation, and by 2049, you know, China is going to become the most powerful economic and military power in the world, and the world will speak Chinese. Many people think that he was just talking figuratively there about like, oh, the world will speak Chinese. But if you look at, you know, institutions like the Confucius Institute and Chinese soft power through the Belt and Road Initiative, they are setting up many colonies in much of Central Asia, even in parts of Africa, teaching the local population Chinese and buying off their, you know, political elites to make them more aligned to China. They're using loans and entrapping nations through the, you know, debt trap, and pretty much taking away those countries' sovereignty piece by piece. And this is their ultimate goal, is to essentially global domination. They want the world to bow down to China.
This is a chilling reality. China wants power and control, and for no one to question it. The camps in East Turkestan, or Xinjiang, show that the CCP will stop at nothing to keep on amassing more power and neutralizing any opposition to it. China's aim is to realize this vision far beyond its borders. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has said that in the months and years ahead, we should expect China and certain other powers to grow far more powerful. In his February 2020 article called "The Climax of Man's Rule Over Man," he writes, "We are in the outer edges of this catastrophic storm. Events taking place in Xinjiang and Hong Kong, China, in Russia and its periphery, in Europe and Latin America, and in the Middle East have everything to do with this. U.S. weakness is putting its allies on dangerous ground. Many nations are realizing they cannot trust America for protection anymore. They have to make peace with China, Russia, and these other nations if they are to survive in the new global order that's taking shape." End quote. To understand more about what's behind the new global order that's now taking shape, which we see terrifying evidence of in East Turkestan, and to understand what's ahead and how to have hope even as China's shadow darkens and expands, please read Mr. Fleury's full article, "The Climax of Man's Rule Over Man."
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
In these difficult times, it is more important than ever to prioritize our relationship with God and build intimacy in that relationship. God wants to draw closer to us. He wants to fill our minds and our lives more, to become a bigger part of our lives. And as the world is crumbling, it should be getting easier for us to turn our backs on this world. There's so many elements of this world that are just proving to be corruptible and problematic. And in many ways, if our interest is waning in those things, that's a good thing. Because at the same time, God is reaching out to us. He's trying to clear away distractions from our lives and build that intimate and personal relationship with us. James 4 and verse 1 says, "From where come wars and fightings among you? Come they not hence, even of your lusts that war in your members?" It's talking about just how this world is so alienated from God and filled with Satan's influence. Now, verse 4 of this chapter says, "You adulterers and adulteresses, know you not that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God." Really, it's one or the other. You're either close to this world or you're close to God. Verse 6 says, "God resists the proud, but gives grace unto the humble." Now, this is a really interesting statement. How do you get close to God? How do you build intimacy with God? Well, you have to eliminate your pride. Eliminate your vanity and self-love. That is what separates you from God. God resists the proud, but God gives grace to the humble, to the person with a broken and contrite spirit. So this is really about seeing yourself properly in relation to God, seeing how great God is, how loving and righteous He is, and just how weak and limited and pitiful and lacking in love we are. When we have that right perspective, that brings us closer to God. And just to finish this thought, in this passage in James 4, verse 10 says, "Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and He shall lift you up." This is talking about purging out that pride that separates you. Humble yourself before God. And then verse 7, also in this passage, this is really important. It says, "Submit yourselves therefore to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you." If you submit to God and obey God, who is your Father, in whom you can trust, if you do as he says, like an obedient child, then that will help you to resist Satan. And God says, if you resist Satan, he will give you the power to conquer him. You resist him and he's going to flee from you, not because you have that power, but because God gives it to you. And then verse 8, it says, draw near to God and he will draw near to you. It's a wonderful promise from God. You reach out to your Father and he's going to reach back to you. We need to keep drawing nearer and nearer to God throughout our lives. Keep growing in greater love for our Father and our husband, Jesus Christ. Come to know them better and better, not just an intellectual understanding, but really knowing them in our hearts. Now, to do that, we have to really battle our human nature. This passage goes on saying, cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be afflicted and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned into mourning and your joy to heaviness. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Eternal, as we read, and he shall lift you up. So this is a very involved process. Naturally, we tend to resist drawing near to God. Naturally, we are lazy and stubborn and self-willed. So we have to be determined and disciplined about humbling ourselves and submitting to God and resisting the devil and actively drawing near to God. If we do those things, then this passage says your Father is really going to respond to that. You move from just knowing about God, having like an intellectual understanding about God, to really knowing God. That's growing in real intimacy with God. When you're praying to God, you're not just getting your prayer in, you're really getting into your prayer. You're bringing God more into your thoughts and your decisions. You're coming to know him better and growing in your desire to please your Father. That's really what God is looking for from all of us. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. Keep drawing nearer and nearer to him and get to know him better and better. Keep building that love more deeply all the time. As you draw near to God, you're going to see your own sins more clearly. Your Father is going to correct you. He's going to help you to purge out your human nature more and more. And he's going to clear out whatever is getting in the way of your relationship with him. To illustrate this point, I really want to look at a passage in, a series of events that took place in the Old Testament in the time of Moses. You remember at Mount Sinai, when God was addressing the children of Israel directly, he was clothed in a thick cloud of darkness. There was thunder and lightning when God gave them the Ten Commandments. And it's interesting, it says in verse 18 of Exodus 20, the beginning of that chapter is where you read the Ten Commandments themselves. And it says, all the people saw the thunderings and the lightnings and the noise of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they removed and stood afar off. Now, this is the way that human nature tends to respond. They got to look at just how powerful God was, and it terrified them. They went away from God. Verse 19 says, they said to Moses, speak you with us and we will hear, but let not God speak with us, lest we die. Now, Moses had a very different reaction. It says in verse 20, Moses said unto the people, fear not, for God has come to prove you, and that his fear may be before your faces, that you sin not. In other words, you have the wrong kind of fear here. God doesn't want you to have fear that makes you pull away from him. He wants you to have fear that makes you obey. Verse 21 says, and the people stood afar off, and Moses drew near unto the thick darkness where God was. The people drew away, but Moses drew near that cloud. Totally opposite responses. Now, Moses was odd as well. In fact, we read in Hebrews 12 and verse 21, so terrible was the sight that Moses said, I exceedingly fear and quake. But he didn't let that fear drive him away from God. Now, where do you and I fall on this spectrum? We have the same human nature to contend with that the Israelites had. Maybe you get some correction from God. Does that make you pull away from him? Or do you draw nearer to him? Do you grow in the kind of fear that makes you more childlike, more obedient? If you look in Deuteronomy 5, you see Moses reminding the Israelites some years later. It was really a new generation of Israelites that he was pointing them back to that history and reminding them of what happened there in Mount Sinai. Deuteronomy 5:23 says, and it came to pass when you heard the voice out of the midst of the darkness, for the mountain did burn with fire, that you came near unto me, even all the heads of your tribes and your elders, and you said, behold, the Eternal our God has showed us his glory and his greatness, and we've heard his voice out of the midst of the fire. We've seen this day that God does talk with man and he lives. So this is awesome. They actually got to see God's glory and his greatness and hear his voice and witness with their own eyes that God talks with man. How many people in history have ever experienced that? I'm sure you would love to see that yourself. But what was their response? Moses continues with them. Now, therefore, why should we die? He's quoting the Israelites' own words. Why should we die? For this great fire will consume us if we hear the voice of the Eternal our God any more than we shall die. This is absolutely illogical. It's just ridiculous reasoning that the Israelites were engaging in. They were using an excuse to pull away. Again, this shows you there's something really wrong with human nature. And Moses continues here in verse 27, go you near and hear all that the Eternal our God shall say, and speak you unto us all that the Eternal our God shall speak unto you, and we will hear it and do it. So they wanted a go-between. The Israelites didn't want direct contact with God. It was just too much for them. Now, Moses gives some insight into how God felt about this. Here's God reaching out to them. He wants to draw near to them, and they're pulling away from him. Verse 28, Moses says, and the Eternal heard the voice of your words when you spoke unto me. And the Eternal said to me, I've heard the voice of the words of this people which they've spoken unto you. They have well said all that they've spoken. And then he says, oh, that there were such a heart in them that they would fear me and keep all my commandments always, that it might be well with them and with their children forever. There's something wrong with the human heart. That's what God was saying. And that's true of all of us. God wants a direct relationship with his children. He doesn't want to have someone in the way. Now, in his church, there is government. God does work through a man, and he has to have order and organization in the church. But he doesn't want human beings looking to that man rather than looking to him. God had placed Moses in power. He had put Moses in charge on the human level over the nation of Israel, but he didn't want them looking to him to the point that they were looking to a man more than they were looking to the God behind that man. God has to be supreme. That man is a help, but the supreme love God is trying to build is with him. The first and great commandment is love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and might. I think about my own children. Coming to really know my children isn't easy. What are they thinking? What makes them tick? You know, it seems like half the time they don't even know what they're thinking. But there's also just the issue of sometimes they just don't want to exert the effort to communicate with me. And of course, I'm human and I have my responsibility for that failure as well. But maybe they don't want to bring me in. They want to remain independent. These are exactly the kinds of tendencies in our human nature that hinder our relationship with God. We could all do better at bringing him in more and going to him more, being more wholehearted in pursuing him. God wanted to give all the Israelites his statutes and judgments. But because of their fear, he was only able to give them to Moses. And we read in Exodus 24 and verse 3, after God gave those statutes and judgments to Moses, it says, Exodus 24, verse 3, Moses came and told the people all the words of the Eternal and all the judgments. And all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Eternal has said, we will do. So then they made a covenant. They made an agreement between God and the nation. And you put this in the context of the way that the Israelites had slighted God and said that they didn't want to deal with God directly. You realize something was wrong here from the very beginning. This was actually a marriage covenant. And just imagine marrying someone who didn't want personal contact with you. Something very, very odd about that. But verse 8 here in Exodus 24, Moses took the blood, he sprinkled it on the people, and he said, behold, the blood of the covenant which the Eternal has made with you concerning all these words. Then went up Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel. And there was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of a sapphire stone, and as it were, the body of heaven in his clearness. So God gave all these people a beautiful vision of himself. This is as spectacular as anything in the Bible. It just shows how still God deeply desired that personal relationship with his people. After this, God brought Moses up to the mount alone, and he gave him all the instructions for the Ark of the Covenant, the tabernacle, the priesthood, the sacrifices. And if you think about all of that, What was all of that about? What did God want to accomplish through all of those physical appurtenances that he instructed Moses to create? Exodus 29, verse 42 says, this shall be a continual burnt offering throughout your generations at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation before the Eternal, where I will meet you to speak there unto you. And there will I meet with the children of Israel, and the tabernacle shall be sanctified by my glory. So this tabernacle was a type of God's dwelling in heaven, the Holy of Holies, his very throne room. The ark was a type of his throne with his mercy seat, and God wanted it to be right there in the midst of the Israelites. He wanted to put his glory right there. Verse 44 says, I'll sanctify the tabernacle of the congregation and the altar. I'll sanctify also both Aaron and his sons to minister to me in the priest's office. And I'll dwell among the children of Israel and will be their God. And they shall know that I am the Eternal, their God, that brought them forth out of the land of Egypt, that I may dwell among them. I am the Eternal, their God. That's what it was all about. It was about him dwelling among them. This points to a picture that you read in the book of Revelation. Revelation 21 talks about the tabernacle of God being with men. This is when God actually will come and place his headquarters on this very earth, New Jerusalem. It says he will dwell with them and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. So this is the vision of this spectacular future, this big family reunion where God the Father himself dwells with people. And it's foreshadowed way back here in Exodus 29. Just a spectacular picture. Really, the purpose of our lives is summarized in this history. The purpose of our lives is to draw near to God. The closer to God we grow, the more like God we grow. Now in Exodus 32, Moses is having this phenomenal experience with God. He's receiving all of these laws. And during that period, the Israelites, who had just made that covenant with God, they manufactured a golden calf. This is after they had said, all that God tells us we will do. But it's right in this context here in Exodus 32, we learn a lot about Moses' relationship with God. It's a beautiful picture of the kind of relationship that God wants to build with all of us. Exodus 32 and verse 9, says, "The Eternal said to Moses, I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Now, therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may wax hot against them, and that I may consume them, and I will make of you a great nation." So God said, I'm going to wipe them out and start again through you, Moses. So at this point, the lives of this entire nation, 2 to 3 million people, plus, you know, all of the billions who would descend from them, including, you know, many of us physically, were in peril. And if Moses had gone along with God, that's what would have happened. But verse 11, it says, Moses besought the Eternal, his God, and said, Eternal, why does your wrath wax hot against this, your people, which you've brought forth out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? So Moses is praying pretty boldly here. He says, wherefore should the Egyptian speak and say, for mischief did he bring him out? He starts to explain to God how this is going to damage God's reputation. There's not too many men who would dare to speak to God this way, but Moses did. He said, turn from your fierce wrath and repent of this evil against your people. Moses wrestled with God, not in a selfish, headstrong way, and not for himself, but he came before the throne of grace boldly to obtain mercy. This is real spiritual courage and boldness. Paul actually commands us to be bold in our prayers in Hebrews 4 and verse 16. That's what Moses did. He says in verse 13 here in Exodus 32, remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swear by your own self and said, I will multiply your seed as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I've spoken of will I give to your seed, and they shall inherit it forever. He's reminding God about all of these promises. Now, Moses' prayers had an impact on the fulfillment of God's plan. And it says in verse 14, the Eternal repented of the evil which he thought to do unto his people. God actually listened. This is an amazing exchange. Moses speaking so boldly to the Almighty God, and God listening and actually changing his mind based on the petition of a human being. It's an extraordinary relationship that God had with this man. Very special. Now, Moses then came down and he saw the golden calf and he saw the sin that the Israelites were committing. And he got very angry. He strongly corrected them. And you see in this passage, he actually killed 3,000 of them. And then you read in verses 30 through 32, it came to pass on the morrow, Moses said to the people, you've sinned a great sin, and now I'll go up to the Eternal. I'm going to make atonement for your sin. Moses went to God and he said, this people have sinned a great sin and have made them gods of gold. Yet now, if you will forgive their sin, and he stops. And then he says, if not, blot me, I pray you, out of your book which you have written. God said that he would start a new nation through Moses. And Moses said, if you're going to wipe them out, please let me die with them. I couldn't bear that. Now God says, whosoever has sinned against me, him will I blot out of my book. Now therefore go, lead the people unto the place of which I have spoken unto you. Behold, my angel shall go before them. Nevertheless, in the day when I visit, will I visit their sin upon them. So these exchanges between Moses and God in these chapters, as they're wrestling with how to handle the Israelites, shows us just how invested they both were in this situation. It also shows just what a beautiful friendship they had. In Exodus 33, you see Moses moves his tent outside the camp where he can talk with God away from the people. And verse 9 says, it came to pass as Moses entered the tabernacle, the cloudy pillar descended and stood at the door of the tabernacle, and the Eternal talked with Moses. And then there's this extraordinary statement in verse 11. The Eternal spoke to Moses face to face as a man speaks unto his friend. That's the relationship that God is looking for with all of his sons. This is the being who would become Jesus Christ speaking to a man who would one day become part of the bride of Christ. He didn't speak like a king to a subject. He spoke like a man to his friend. Two friends speaking in intimate, personal, affectionate terms with one another. God was speaking to Moses, but he was also listening. Verse 12 says, "And Moses said to the Eternal, 'See, you say unto me, bring up this people, and you have not let me know whom you will send with me.'" God had said he would send an angel, but that he wouldn't go. And this was a real concern to Moses. He says, "Yet you have said, I know you by name, and you have also found grace in my sight. Now, therefore, I pray you, if I have found grace in your sight, show me now your way that I may know you, that I may find grace in your sight and consider that this nation is your people." This is just a beautiful prayer that he's praying. He's saying, show me your way that I may know you, because I want to know you better and better. I want to find more and more favor in your sight. I want to get closer and closer to you. And he said, "My presence shall go with you, and I will give you rest." God actually, again, responded to him favorably. And Moses said, "If your presence go not with me, carry us not up hence." If you aren't personally going to come with us, then I don't want to go anywhere. I want to be where you are. How do you suppose God felt about that? How moving was that to God? He's dealing with this people that want to hold him at arm's length, and he has this man who says, "I just want to be with you. Teach me about yourself so I can be closer to you." Verse 17, "The Eternal said to Moses, 'I will do this thing also that you have spoken, for you have found grace in my sight, and I know you by name.'" God really listened to Moses. He fulfilled this man's request. Moses was drawing near to God, and God responded by drawing near to Moses. He was talking with him face to face like a man speaks with his friend. And Moses couldn't actually see him. He could hear his voice, but God was always surrounded by a thick cloud that you couldn't see through. Now notice what Moses says next. Verse 18, he said, "I beseech you, show me your glory." Moses wanted to actually see God. He's as close as any man has ever been, and he wanted to be still closer. Such a contrast from the Israelites, who were terrified of God. Moses wanted to get closer and closer. He wanted to hear God and see God. Just think of, really, he'd been having some awesome success in his prayers. And God was saying, "Yes, I'll do what you say." And it made Moses even bolder in talking to God. That's a marvelous goal in our own prayer life. Draw closer and closer to your Father and get bolder and bolder. When you're really close to God in prayer, keep pressing forward like Moses did. Now, God said if he actually showed Moses his face, it would kill Moses. And he couldn't do that. But it's like he wanted so much to grant Moses his request that he said, "Okay, I'll put you in a crack in the rock, and I'm going to pass by, and I'm going to let you see my back." What an amazing experience Moses had with God. And it's all recorded for us. Exodus 34 and verse 29 says this: "It came to pass when Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tables of testimony in Moses' hand, he came down from the mount, that Moses didn't realize the skin of his face shone while he talked with him. And when Aaron and all the children of Israel saw Moses, behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him. It alarmed them so much that they said, 'You need to put a veil over your face.'" We're talking about 15th century BC face masks. They couldn't handle it. The proximity to God, the glory of God. Now, we should not have those issues. We need to follow Moses' example. This man who didn't shrink from God, but he soaked up as much of the glory of God as he possibly could. 2 Corinthians 3 verses 12 through 14 says, "Seeing then that we have such hope, we use great plainness of speech, and not as Moses, which put a veil over his face, that the children of Israel could not steadfastly look to the end of that which is abolished, but their minds were blinded. For until this day remains the same veil untaken away in the reading of the Old Testament, which veil is done away in Christ. There is so much glory in the Old Testament. And when you understand the New Testament, when you see the whole picture and you understand the parallels and you see that the church today is spiritual Israel, you can see that glory. Christ removes that veil and you can see all that glory. Verses 15 and 16 say, "But even unto this day when Moses is read, the veil is upon their heart. Nevertheless, when it shall turn to the Lord, the veil shall be taken away." It's our carnality that puts that obstacle there, but God wants to remove that so we can see that glory. Verses 17 and 18 say, "Now the Lord is that Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. But we all, with open face, beholding as in a glass the glory of the Lord, are changed into the same image from glory to glory, even as by the Spirit of the Lord." The first and great commandment is to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and might. Do all you can to keep that commandment, to love God wholeheartedly. He loves us. He is our Father. He wants to bless us and give us so much. And He will, as long as we are obedient, loving sons. And we are working to draw near to Him. Draw near to God, and He will draw near to you. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Dan Arnfield, Jeremiah Jacques, and Salih Hudayar. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from John Paul Richter. "As winter strips the leaves from around us so that we may see the regions they formerly concealed, so old age takes away our enjoyments only to enlarge the prospect of the coming eternity." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.